cliffcentral.com.
All righty, it's all happening this morning. It's a busy Wednesday. Hello, it's the Martian. 19 minutes after 8. Cool. Damien Baldek Wasiewicz. Have I got that surname right? How do I say this? Wasiewicz. What? No, hang on. Hold on a second. Say it again.
Hey, man. It's Wasiewicz.
Wasiewicz. You're Polish.
Polish, yeah.
So is Karpinski.
We should have put vodka. Yeah. Ahead of a vodka party.
There's so many Poles in the studio at the moment. Surprised I'm not dying from the fumes.
You know what? We're good for blue-collar work.
No, but there are a lot of Poles in South Africa, actually.
Yeah.
And they've all done pretty well.
Yeah, I think it's...
hard-working people.
Hard-working. The country was annexed by other nations for hundreds of years. And
you know what I got to say for Polish, particularly Polish women?
Yeah.
Is that they have a lovely mix of like that Scandinavian look from the north. They've got a little bit of that Germanic kind of Teutonic look from the west. Yeah. From the east, they've got that Russian iciness, and they've got that Eastern European porn appeal from the south. So it's a good combo.
You clearly thought about it quite a lot, eh?
I had a Polish girlfriend once in high school.
Everyone does.
I thought about it.
Everyone does.
So, damn right. All right. Damien and Valdek Vaskovic, is that right? Vasovic, are in the studio with us. They are supporting Headway, which is obviously something that I care very much about. Headway, for Mandela Day, by the way, gave out 1,000 packs of all kinds of goodies to all the emergency services workers. That's people in the fire departments, the rescue people, the cops who arrive on the scenes. You know, what Headway do is, and that was part of their Mandela Day, giving back to the people who've really helped a lot of the patients at Headway. Headway is an organization that takes care of people who've had traumatic brain injuries, and they do an amazing job of this. They've helped to get some of these people who've just, you know, they've been living their lives like you and me. They're walking around town, they're driving around town, some kind of accident happens, it's hardly ever their fault, as if these things could be attributed to fault, and then they end up with a brain injury that it just changes your life in an instant, and everything's different. I mean, you imagine, you go from being just a normal member of society to suddenly needing assistance with just about everything. There's a lot of therapy that takes place. There's a lot of counseling that takes place. Headway are just one of those organizations. They're a non-profit. They need donations. People need to help them, because otherwise their good work will just not be able to affect the lives positively of so many people that they already have. So I'm a massive supporter of Headway, and I got to congratulate them on giving back on Mandela Day. You'd think that people who really often need the support more than anything else are the ones who are least likely to give back, but these guys' hearts are so big that they did this marvelous thing on Nelson Mandela Day. That was just on Monday this week. But their day-to-day work continues, and they do deserve and need a whole lot more support. So you two have decided, and Damien, I haven't even said hello to you yet.
Hi.
So how are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Cool, man. What was your brain injury? What happened to you?
Well, it is a long story, and I'm not sure how much time we have, but...
I'll tell you when to stop.
Excellent. It started off with an arbitrary event, believe it or not.
What happened?
A volcano actually blew up in Iceland, and it caused a lot of...
I remember that.
Yeah, in about 2010, and a lot of ash as well as gas went into the atmosphere, and flights were cancelled. Mm-hmm. I was supposed to be flying over to the UK on Sunday to work there, and I was grounded. As such, I thought to myself, what to do?
You were in Iceland?
No, I was in South Africa at that stage.
Oh, okay.
I was going to fly from South Africa to London,
mm-hmm.
but traffic was brought to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
As such, Tuesday was a public holiday. I believe it was Freedom Day, if my memory is correct.
Mm-hmm.
I took Monday off. I convinced my brother to do the same and for us to go for a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
At that stage, I was 30 years of age. I mean, I was a very, very fit guy. We went to a place called Sekebos Rand, which is south of Johannesburg.
It's like a nature reserve.
Correct. Yeah. A beautiful, beautiful place to cycle. It was my brother, Valdek, sitting next to me, as well as my younger brother, Adrian. He was 16 at that stage. Went for a cycle. As we cycled up one of the hills, and as we were getting to a crux, to the top of the actual hill,
mm-hmm.
a service delivery vehicle came speeding in the opposite direction, about 90 km/h. It missed my my elder brother Voldek, as well as my younger brother Adrian, and swerved right into me.
Oh, Jesus.
It hit me head on at about 90 k's an hour.
Oh my God.
So inertia being what inertia is, my hands went flying into its bonnet, and that explains some of the knuckles which have shifted back. My shoulder, my shoulder went flying into the bonnet itself, and almost actually lost the shoulder. There were doctors were looking to put an artificial.
So you were a mess. I mean, you must have been like mincemeat.
Gareth, my skull was broken in so many places. My nose was broken. My jaw was broken. God. My cheekbones were broken. One of my eyes actually shifted back. I was being Polish. I'm always very, very interested in new English words, and I managed to learn a new English word that day, which is called degloving. And that is what happens when your scalp is cut from one ear to the other ear, and your face actually comes off.
Good Lord.
As inertia, being the bitch that she is, she carried going. So I flew over the actual roof of the car. Four vertebrae were injured at that stage. One was cracked, three were compressed, and the various discs were compressed as well.
I mean, you could have just as easily been paralyzed forever, right?
Well, Gareth, it's actually funny what you're saying. And coming back to my earlier story about this volcano erupting, and this is where the first little miracle happened. My brother drove me in that same buggy in which I was lying at the back of it, down to a Protea hotel.
Mm-hmm.
We asked for help. No one was able to help. No one was able to give us a medical aid kit.
Mm-hmm.
No one was able to provide us with a phone number to dial an ambulance. And there was one chap there called Nigel Henderson. Nigel was a chap from the UK, mm-hmm, who just got married to a South African girl. And he was supposed to fly on Sunday, believe it or not, back to the UK to his family. Owing to that volcano, he just happened to be in South Africa, as he couldn't fly back,
mm-hmm,
and he was in Sekebos Rand. He managed to stabilize me.
Was he a doctor?
Well, he actually wasn't a doctor, but he did undertake military schooling in the UK.
Okay.
And had some medical background behind him. So he managed to stabilize me. By the time I got to Union Hospital in Alberton, I lost 6 liters of blood, and you only have 8 liters in your body.
Jeez.
So whatever happened, those little miracles that happened along the way were fabulous, and that's why I'm here and speaking to you today.
Now, Headway obviously got involved after all of this. It's part of your rehabilitation, right? You have occupational therapists, and there are a whole lot of people there to help you kind of figure out how to deal with the brain injury, because for some people it's very severe, for other people it's less severe.
Yeah,
What was your status at that stage?
Well, I mean, my status for the first week, I believe my survival rate was under 10%. For the next week, it was under 20%. Mm-hmm. Thereafter, my family was told, and I think this is the important part about recovery. The first side of the recovery, I wasn't present. I was lying there in a coma, in a induced coma for the first 10 days. Thereafter, I was on drugs, etc., etc. The first part of recovery is where your family and your loved ones get involved, and the trauma is actually on them. So that they heard the stories about me only having 10% chance of survival.
Voldek, did you think he was going to die?
Yeah, listen, we were told categorically that if he lives, he'll be in a nappy for the rest of his life. And I mean,
that's all.
Listen, the training doctors, you know, no. God bless them. They've got an empathy of an ox. Basically, looked at his X-rays and said, "This guy's dead." And we said, "No, no, he's alive." And they said, "No, he's dying." And I had to fight with them. But yeah, listen, we pretty much said, "Look, if he survives, we're going to have a vegetable on our hands, and we're gonna have to look after this guy." And I think what happened was, you know, doctors work on statistics and they work on historical data, but every way, every marker across, you know, every time Damien exceeded expectations. And when we were told that he would die, he somehow survived. Then after 10 days, he came out of a coma. Then we were told that he would be sitting in hospital for 6 months. After 6 weeks, he was discharged to Donegordon. And he kept on fighting. And I think
it
was his fighting spirit. It's maybe you mentioned Viking blood or something.
What I'm thinking here is that, first of all, cycling is a very dangerous, shitty thing to do. So don't do that anymore. Now you want to cycle.
Too late.
No, you know what? we're going to get you on a bicycle.
No, you won't.
No, you will.
Never. With stories like this, I'm going to stay the hell away.
No, but I think the you know, what makes this even more tragic is that Damien didn't drink himself or smoke himself into a stroke.
No.
He didn't indulge in a bad lifestyle.
He was doing things that are very healthy.
And
fit.
People go for a run every day. People go for a cycle every day.
There's no way you could have foreseen this happening.
And in a nature reserve, which has got blocked off traffic. So he was doing what a lot of people do every single day. He was doing what he loves. And he was hit with this tragedy. And this could really happen to anyone.
That's the point.
That's training for, you know, any race.
This is why I love what Headway do, is because this really could happen to anybody. And the fact that it had to happen to you is horrible. And I'm sorry about that. But you've made an incredible recovery. I mean, you're back to living your normal life, right?
Correct. I mean, it hasn't been an easy journey. And I guess what I want to try to do by coming together with Headway is actually to share the story, to share the little tricks that I picked up along the way on how to actually recover. I mean, a recovery process is very much like life. You have to get from A to B, and you've got your ups and downs. The only difference is that in a recovery process, those ups and those downs are extreme, especially on the lower side. And also your ups and downs are compressed in time. So it doesn't happen once every day, once every 2 days. Yeah. It happens each and every time you try to do something. And I'll give you an example of what happened to me. I remember waking up from the coma, and I'm not sure whether it was the first time, the 10th time, the 100th time that I've woken up. I remember seeing a bit of light and a bit of white. It took a bit of time for me to realize I was actually staring at a ceiling. Mm. Thereafter, I looked down and I saw my family. And that is something that brought peace to me. And that's why support, be that from your family or your loved ones, is important during these terrible times. But at that stage, I found myself, I felt like Neo. I was connected to the Matrix. I had pipes coming out of, I had a trachea coming out of my neck. Mm. I had another pipe coming out of my stomach. I had another pee pump coming out of the other parts of my body.
Penis.
That's right.
Say it. That's say it right. As it is.
It was a big pipe. I do have to say that. And for love of me, I was a man 30 years of age. I was a man who was capable prior to this accident occurring. Now, all of a sudden, I couldn't even get up to go and have a pee by myself.
It's debilitating in every way, right? It's almost humiliating in some ways.
Yeah, and it plays on your head so much, I think, that you then end up, and I mean, I remember Damien questioning himself in many other ways, because then you attribute everything to that accident. So, you know, you could be a little bit forgetful before the accident, but because you had the accident, every time you forget something,
oh my God, everything's going
everything
downhill.
Everything is because of my accident.
And that is the important thing for people to remember. You were never perfect before. And Gareth, I'm very sorry to say this to you, but you're not a perfect man either.
No, what do you mean?
No, honestly.
No, I know. Oh, trust me. And I look in the mirror every morning. I'm fully aware.
And that is one of the tricks. Do not ever think that you are perfect. Do not ever think that you will recover to be a Superman, because you were never a Superman to begin with.
You're absolutely right. All right, I want to talk quickly about what you're doing, because we're almost out of time. You guys are going to be doing a cycling challenge as a means to raise funds for Headway.
Yeah.
What exactly is this? Tell me.
Well, yeah, you know, I think you mentioned on Monday as well, I was listening to your show, the word sustainable came up.
Yeah.
And I think we're fully on board with that. I think it's very easy for people these days to give money as a once-off and run. What we want to do is create a sustainable model where we can engage with people who, A, love cycling, and B, want to do some good, and connect them with Headway, but we want to plug them in, and we want to get them involved throughout the year. So we're going to be kicking off as a platform starter. We want to start with a 94.7 charity drive.
Very good.
But a lot of charities use that as an end-all and be-all, and that's the end of it. What we want to use that is as a starter and as a first platform start, a kickoff, really. But then make sure that we have events throughout the year, and we want to do one or two big endurance events to raise money, and B, to show that Damien can do it, and that he's capable of riding a Cape Epic or a 361, which is already done. And he's already achieved some amazing feats. And the key is that we want to maybe also take people who want to ride, but maybe never really have, they don't feel that they can ride, but they want to connect with Headway. But they may be a little bit shy to learn how to ride a bike.
How can they do this?
And we'll and we'll help them.
How can they do it?
Yeah. For now, they must just follow Hedwig Gauteng on Facebook.
All right.
Go onto the website. We'll have more information going out. I think in the next week or two, we'll have some posts going up on how they can connect with us.
Cool. We can take
it from there. And hopefully, Gareth, we can use your platform to maybe
we'll make sure we put all the info on cliffcentral.com
Fantastic. As well, brilliant.
So that anyone who's looking can find it. Guys, well done. Damien, I'm very pleased you're here and that you're okay. And you really are an inspiring story in terms of the successes that Hedwig can help people achieve. Getting back to normality, sorting out their lives. It's not a death sentence.
Yeah, that's right.
And you don't have to. I mean, your family thought that you'd end up being a vegetable and look at you. You're back to normal. It's amazing what can be done.
Yeah, quarter of a vegetable.
It's a fruit, not a vegetable. All right, well, listen, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to meet you both, and congratulations on doing this for Hedwig. I think that's a terrific achievement. Damien and Valdek Vasovic.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gareth, and thanks for the good work you do as well.
Sure, well, a little bit. But there we go. And meet your fellow Polak, Ben Karpinski. Say hello to them, Ben.
Hello, hello.
All right. Ben doesn't speak any Polish.
We'll teach you.
Sorry, he doesn't. It's very embarrassing. I've tried this a couple of times, and every Polish people come in here, he just ignores
it. Bad for picking up Polish woman.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's Radioactive. Now, I don't have to explain that I am a massive fan of history, and that I'm interested in the history of this country in a big way. I try to find out as much as I can about it. The one province that has a fascinating, rich history, but we don't know everything we need to know about it, is the Eastern Cape. I mean, this is the place of King Hintsa, of the border wars, of all kinds of really, really interesting stuff that led up to the more recent history, the apartheid history of the Eastern Cape. It's the birthplace of the ANC. There's plenty to talk about there, and someone called Simkeli Lerubela is here with us this morning. Hey, Simkeli, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks very much for having me.
Sure, I got your name right, huh?
Yeah, it's Simkeli. I think you got it right.
My surname is
Rubela.
Rubela,
yeah,
that's what I said.
Okay,
I fucking got it right.
Yeah, many people get it wrong, but you got it right.
Nice to meet you, man.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here as well.
Now, you've written this, it's a novel called To the Bitter End, but you obviously had to do a whole lot of historical research for this.
Yes.
I mean, the Eastern Cape is, as I said, a rich tapestry of South Africa's history. In many ways, the stories in the Eastern Cape are stories that are perpetuated in modern society in South Africa because they have deep roots. You yourself from the same place as O.R. Tambo. You were born in the same place as him.
Yes, I'm from Ebizana, where O.R. Tambo was born, where Winnie Madikizela Mandela was born also. So in my book, it follows the story of a little girl who comes from that rural environment, and she goes to the university to pursue her studies with a vision to change the situation back at home. And she encounters challenges along the way because at the time it's set in the historical period before the democratic breakthrough, deliberately just to highlight what was actually happening at the time. And it then will give you a reflection of the society that people of that time lived in, and the tribal tensions as a result of fighting over little land that is available for their grazing and the farming activities, and all those kind of things that affected the children. And then when you grow up in that kind of an environment, you'll then grow up and want to change the situation. And the main character of this book is the young girl who comes from that kind of an environment, and the situation is even worse at home. She goes to the university to pursue her studies, but you'd understand just before the democratic breakthrough, when the political parties were banned and there was some kind of a rebirth of activism.
So we're talking late 80s here?
No, we're talking in the early 90s.
Okay.
In the early 90s. And then at that time, when she arrives at the university, the situation is almost worse. And she gets absorbed in that kind of situation, and the novel progresses from that background.
Now, what I'm interested in, though, is kind of your own experiences, which must have fed into this. I mean, what was it like being born in Bizana, and obviously you've got quite a lot of traditional leadership there.
Yes, you've got quite a lot of
what was then the old Transkei.
Yes, where
Kaiser Matanzima was in control. Bantu Holomisa played an important role in terms of how that evolved as a political system. But this is the same province that gave us the Mbekis, the Tambos, the Mandelas. So there must be a fierce pride in being Xhosa, first of all. But they're different kinds of Xhosa because they're different clans.
Yes. Yeah.
And they all pretty much are, as you said earlier, fighting for the same little piece of land to graze their cattle on. And if a certain clan is dominant at a certain time, it means that the others are having a really shitty time. That's pretty much how it works, right?
Yes. Growing up in that part of the country, as a little boy, I was born in the late 80s. Some of these things, I get them through the history. Fortunately, I still have my grandfather.
Yeah, your mom and dad died, in the early 2000s?
Yeah, in 2004 and 2005.
Sure, so you lost them both in a very short space of time.
Yeah.
How old are you now?
I was still in high school. I'm going to be 28 in Sunday. I'm turning 28.
When you lose both your parents, this is a big deal. I mean, you must have felt like at that stage you were all alone in this big, scary world. I mean, you're in high school. It's not like you experienced it life.
Yeah, it was a bit horrific. But fortunately, you know, in an African society, you live as a huge family because you've got extended family here.
So you're absorbed
here,
into
your uncles, your everyone. Yeah. And then when the immediate parents die, you have at least somebody within the family, if at least there's somebody who can afford to manage you and even take you up to university, because that's how I went to university. I had my uncles, my aunt, my grandma, my granddad. So those are the people who were able to then take us through the life after the death of our parents. Even that, I think it's one of the experiences that might have nurtured me, because at that early age you have to grow up because you've got little brothers that are coming after you, and if you mess up you're indirectly killing their future as well. So you must be very responsible with your own, so that these ones who are coming after you will also learn a thing or two from you, and then would be able to tell the line of march. So them passing away at that early age is in fact coming from a village where young people of my age, in particular of my age, I think I was amongst the first people, for instance, to have a matric from my village. So despite that tragedy that happened, I still managed to compose myself and still remain focused. Of course, with the guidance of the extended family, and then at least the brows was not very much detrimental to my progress, I can say.
When you're in the Eastern Cape and you grow up as a young boy there, what's the dream? Because you can only imagine what it would be like to be in the city. You're far from it. It's almost like a distant thing that you maybe will attain, maybe you won't. Maybe you don't want to go there because you feel at home, you feel safe, you feel secure in Bizana.
You know, how you picture the world is how you see it. Definitely. And then when you come from that part of the world, especially when there was no much exposure to most of the things, with very few households with television, for instance, you grow up picturing yourself looking like somebody else who has managed to have a progress in the society. In fact, a progress that can be defined maybe by a particular occupation. Maybe this person is a police person and is respected in the society. This other one is a teacher, and this other one,
who were your inspirations?
So at that time, when you are growing up, you always look up to those people in the village. And then I wouldn't say a single person was my inspiration, but as a little boy, but those people in the community would have a better occupation, of course, would always be those people. Everybody in the community would want to be like them, like the teachers, like my aunt is a teacher. And then there are other people, the policemen and all those. So those are the better people in the community when you're growing up. So growing up, you always have those dreams. But as you get exposed, then just like any career decision is influenced by conditions at given time. So you'd always learn new things and getting interested in new things and also. So, but basically growing up in the community where it's dominated by poverty and very few people who have progressed career-wise and otherwise, mm-hmm. you'd always want to be like them.
What happens to your character in the book? Don't give me the whole story, but
yes.
clearly she starts off, you said she goes to university, she manages to get to the city.
Well, one critical issue, the message I wanted to communicate, the central message of that novel, as the title portrays, it's to the bitter end. It's a figurative representation of determination of the main character to keep going regardless of the situation. And I'm saying this story takes you back in the historical moment in our society back then, where there was apartheid, there were tribal tensions, there was a lot of unrest at the time. So uh-huh. this young girl, regardless of the situation, still managed to pursue her dreams and still managed to fight, still managed against all odds to fight and remain focused and achieved what she wanted to achieve. So that's the central theme of the book.
So it's an inspiring story. I mean, it's a story that will make people feel that even if they're not having the best time right now, that, you know, if they work hard at it, they can get there and really don't give up.
Most definitely, most definitely, mm. most definitely. Because even this little girl, what she had, what happens with her, for instance, she's a young girl who was raised by her grandmother after her mother died, after his dad disappeared. And then she's left with this grandmother and then the little boy at home. And that kind of situation also fuels her to want to do better, to change the situation. Because she thinks, she feels the responsibility to want to do something because she is the only one who can do things better because her grandmother is aged and the little boy that comes after is still very young. In the midst of those tribal quagmires where there is always a war, people sleeping in the riverbanks and all that.
What are the tribal situations in the book? I mean, are these real life situations that you observed, or are they things that you invented to illustrate a point?
Well, the book is a fiction, but of course the fiction will be influenced by your experience, maybe by your study of history or by anything. But this one, although it's a fiction,
mm-hmm.
there are tribal tensions, for instance, that are still existing in Transkei.
What tribal tensions are we
talking
about?
The tribal tensions that I'm talking about, for instance, will have a particular village that is not in good terms with the other village. And when you trace where this thing comes from, you always find out it's got something to do maybe with the land, maybe something to do with the livestock theft, mm-hmm. and those kind of things. And these things get transferred from generations to the generation. For instance, where I come from, we are not in good terms with the other village.
Which village is not the, which you village know, is your enemy?
It's a nearby village.
What's it called?
It's called Kwabipa. It's a close name. You can't, okay. you know. So the point I'm making is we, this generation, don't actually know where that thing comes from.
But you it take it on anyway.
Us. Yeah, it still affects us. Like, for instance, where there is everybody, you know, in December, everybody's back home.
Mm-hmm.
And we are always told, hey, when you are drinking, don't go drink that side. Those people are going to beat you up. And you wonder, why? What's the problem? We grew up together with these people. So those things have got a deeply seated history that is not of our own invention. It comes from our forefathers. In as much as now, it may not necessarily be about land, but that kind of a tension.
It's in the bones, right?
Yeah, it lives with us now. It needs the current generation to be able to change it. So that's the situation the book also tries to paint. Though it's a fiction, but if you go to in Transkei, you'll still find those kind of situations in the villages.
Is it something that in your book, does she get into a relationship with some guy who's from a village which is not a village that her village gets along with? I mean, how do you incorporate this into her story?
No, what actually happens here, is that the main character here...
What's her name?
It's Betty. What happens is that at some point, because these tensions, what happens sometimes when you kill somebody from that village, they then want to come back and revenge. And there's always that kind of a situation. And then her little brother disappears. And it is believed that he has been abducted by the opposing village.
Mm-hmm.
And then she runs to her own chief. And her own chief gives her a problem because she, in the village, they are not in good terms with the rest of the village, but they speak to the few people, because in the village her grandmother is viewed as somebody who's practicing witchcraft.
Uh-oh.
And then she arrives there at night half naked while she's busy crying to say he's going to report to the chief, and the chief's people are saying, why are you here at this time of the day? You are even naked. What kind of a woman walks at night naked? You are practicing witchcraft just like your grandmother, something like that. And then
she gets no support from him.
She gets no support from him. And then there is her uncle, David, in the story. She just came from exile. While in the morning, they were still talking about that, having caught her, and then they called the old village, and then David pops up, and then it stops all of that thing, and then they plan on how they
were going to kill her.
They were going to punish her
for because they thought she was practicing witchcraft, right?
Yeah, and then they plan a revenge too. That other opposing village,
mm-hmm.
with his uncle, David.
With David, right.
Who just came back from exile. Now, what happens is that they found a strategy of getting hold of the opposite chief.
What, like abducting him?
Yes, that they did. And then what happens is that after the death of this chief, there are tensions within the royal family over succession. So those are other issues that you'd usually find.
It's like a political drama.
Yeah, those are other things that you'd usually find in the royal families, especially nowadays when there is money involved in the tribal.
Does she ever find her brother?
Yes, at the end.
Don't tell us how. We don't want
to
know.
Yeah, at the end, it's very much
this.
Interesting. Everybody is believes that Thando is dead. But at the end, something happens. So it's a very much interesting book.
Well, listen, it sounds fascinating. It's called To the Bitter End. And,
yes.
And I saw an email about this the other day, and I thought we've got to get you in here to talk about it. And we've only just scratched the surface because we ran out of time. But I'll tell you something. This is fascinating. His name is Simkelile Rubella. His book is called To the Bitter End. See if you could find it. Where can we get it? Is it online? Can we get it at bookstores?
Now, people can order it from me at the moment.
All right, where are you? Where can we get you?
I'm an independent publisher. And I'm
excellent.
Independent,
I like that.
Yes.
So how can we support you?
It's Sim Rubella. S-I-M.
R-U-B-E-L-A.
R-U-B-E-L-A @gmail.com.
There we go. So we email you directly.
Yes, they email me or call me. WhatsApp,
Sim Rubella. @gmail.com.
Yes.
Got you. Loud and clear. If you want to order this book, To the Bitter End, it sounds like a hell of a story. Some of the events in the former Trans Sky and some of the stories that, even though this is a fictional book, are based on some of the real things that happen in that part of the world. Sounds like an interesting, introspective view of what goes on. If you want to get your hands on something like that, it sounds very, very exciting, then get hold of Sim Rubella. All right, let's wrap it up with the unnews and hand over to Frank Lee Speaking, who are next to take us through the morning. And there's lots of other good stuff. I see Pumi Mashiko is here for Womandla. So there's lots to talk about today. Here's what you need to know to wrap it up this morning. The unnews. Donald Trump Jr. has slammed allegations that his dad's mail order first lady plagiarized her speech from Michelle Obama. Jizz Trumpet Jr., as they call him, said Ivanka wasn't even speaking English in 2008. So how could... Sorry, it's not Ivanka. That would be Melania. Jizz Trumpet Jr. said Melania hasn't even begun speaking English properly. So how could she even have heard Michelle's speech back then? She didn't understand. Yesterday was a brutal axe attack on a train in Germany, leaving four people seriously wounded. German liberal press say they're still investigating the motive for the attack. They say that they can't draw anything into the attacker being a Muslim immigrant with fanatical beliefs, or that he was linked to ISIS, or that he wanted to seek revenge against the infidels. They're committed to continue their investigation, though, until they discover more information. And in other news, the South African Paralympic team was unveiled yesterday to much fanfare and excitement. Minister of Social Media and Turnups, Fikile Mbalula, was on hand to soak up the limelight there, showing great excitement for the hashtag Team SA Rise. The wheelchair-bound athletes, however, weren't as enthusiastic. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Thank you to our guests. Thank you to you. We will pick this up tomorrow, 6 a.m. Don't miss a single thing. CliffCentral.com.